The headlines. Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says what Tehran wants to see from other parties to the 2015 nuclear deal as action, not words. Iran says the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency will travel to Tehran on Saturday, ahead of a deadline by Tehran to suspend the IAEA's snap inspections. And Britain says it wants to see a proof that the daughter of the ruler of Dubai is alive, following the release of video detailing her plight in captivity. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says what Tehran wants to see from other parties to the 2015 nuclear deal is action, not words. Ayatollah Khamenei said superpowers formed a front against the Islamic Republic since the very beginning because Iran rejected their hegemonic policies. He said they have always sought to demonize Iran under baseless pretexts like human rights, regional influence, or nuclear program. Iran's leader said the U.S., Israel, and their allies hatch plots against the Islamic Republic due to the progress that it is making. Ayatollah Khamenei also touched upon Iran's upcoming presidential election. He described the vote as a great opportunity, saying that a high voter turnout is of utmost importance. Iran's leader said electing the right person will guarantee the country's future and continued progress. Iran says the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency will travel to Tehran on Saturday, ahead of a deadline by Iranian lawmakers to suspend snap inspections by the UN nuclear watchdog. Iran's representative to Vienna-based international organizations made the announcement after Tehran said that it is ready for talks with the IAEA. Kazem Gharibabadi said Rafael Mariano Grossi and Iranian officials will hold technical discussions on how to continue the cooperation. This as the Islamic Republic is preparing to cease the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The measure is based on a parliamentary law in response to the failure of the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal to fulfill their obligations. Iran's president says that Tehran will start implementing the legislation as of February the 23rd.
After February 23rd and in line with our parliamentary laws, we will withdraw from the 2015 nuclear deal's additional protocol that we have accepted voluntarily. After that, the cooperation between Tehran and the International Atomic Energy Agency will be based on the safeguards agreement between the two sides.
Rouhani said the IAEA inspections can continue under the safeguards agreement, but once again ruled out any further talks on the Iran nuclear deal. Rouhani noted that he had also rejected calls by former U.S. President Donald Trump negotiating regional issues and Iran's missile capabilities. The Iranian president said that the U.S. has no other option but to return to the negotiating table. Rouhani said that if Washington removes its tyrannical sanctions, Iran will immediately return to full compliance under the nuclear accord. Political analyst Elijah Magnier says the U.S. should start lifting anti-Iran sanctions first because it was the one that withdrew from the nuclear agreement.
President Joe Biden's team has no right to say Iran should first fully comply by the JCPOA. It is not the end of the nuclear deal, and it could be easy to reserve, provide all other sites and all meet their equipment. So ending the additional inspection protocol are voluntary. It doesn't mean that all inspection will stop. The U.S. can start by lifting the sanction, and that means, first of all, allowing Iran crude oil to be sold and problems related to its transportation insurance, and everybody can pay for the oil and Iran can recollect it. So it is not the end of the nuclear deal. It is a stop that is related only to the additional inspector protocol because that is voluntary. And it is for President Rouhani is obliged to abide by the parliament decision that gives the deadline on February 21st. It is up to the U.S. now to show a goodwill and start lifting the sanction first.
The U.S. says it will discuss with the United Arab Emirates about Sheikha Latifa, the daughter of Dubai's ruler, after she reemerged in new videos detailing her plight. The world body says it could launch an investigation into Latifa's fate once the videos released by the BBC are analyzed. The U.K. has also expressed concern with the foreign secretary, saying that his country would like to see proof that the princess is alive. Dominic Raab has described as deeply troubling the footage in which Latifa says that she's being held by her father against her will and that she fears for her life. The BBC says it had independently verified the whereabouts of Latifa after obtaining the clips from her friends. The videos were filmed nearly a year after the princess tried to escape the country in 2018, but was captured and returned back to the UAE. Latifa is the daughter of Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, who serves as the UAE's vice president and prime minister. In 2019, Sheikh Mohammed's ex-wife, Haya bint Al Hussein, fled to London, where she applied for a forced marriage protection order for her school-aged children. Leader of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has called on the people of the region to face what he called the war of normalization. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah also warned Israel that the resistance alliance will transform any future aggression into an opportunity to retaliate against the regime. Mariam Saleh has the report.
In a televised speech, Hezbollah's Secretary General warned Israel that any act of aggression on the Gaza Strip or Lebanon could turn into an all-out war.
In any future confrontation, the home front of the occupation entity will face actualities it has never faced since the establishment of its entity. The time of threats and fear is over. The Resistance Alliance is following up all developments with calm and precision.
Nasrallah reiterated that the Israelis, especially Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, will continue to magnify normalization deals with some Arab states and use the issue for political and electoral gains. Hezbollah's leader, however, stressed that the people of the region will continue to boycott Israel.
Even in those Arab states that are normalizing ties, we bargain on the people. This is the struggle of the people. I'm telling them they do not need to take on arms or shed blood. All you need to do is boycott, which means do not normalize ties. Do not accept Israeli products or meet with Israelis or visit Israelis or welcome Israelis.
Experts believe the resistance has had exceptional achievements in its struggle against the Israeli regime.
The resistance has achieved two victories unprecedented in Arab and Muslim history and has achieved two liberations. Had it not been for the resistance, there would have not been a Lebanon. We need to remember that in 2000 and in 2006, there was no Arab side with the resistance. On the contrary, they conspired against it. There are many challenges facing it. There will be more people against it, and the Israelis will try to continue with their efforts to normalize ties with more Arab regimes while the resistance has become a united regional power.
Nasrallah was speaking on the anniversary of the martyrdom of Hezbollah's former Secretary General, Sayyid Abbas Mousawi, scholar Sheikh Raghib Harb, and military commander Imad Mughni. The martyrdom of these leaders, although at different intervals in the history of the resistance, represents the continued path toward liberation. After some 40 years of resistance and struggle against Israeli occupation and Takfiri terrorism, Hezbollah has lost many commanders, three of whom are commemorated in February of every year. And despite gaining strength and the many victories, Hezbollah's resistance is constantly in a state of defending Lebanon and advocating the need to remain apprehensive of U.S., Israeli, and Takfiri threats. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Yemen's Ansarullah movement says that it will continue its military operations in Ma'arib until the liberation of the city. This comes after a call by the U.S. and the movement to stop its push for taking control of the city. The movement has also reiterated the necessity of a political solution for the Yemen war, emphasizing that Saudi Arabia has to end hostility and blockade. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more from Sana'a.
Yemen's Ansarullah forces have recently resumed an offensive to take control of Ma'arib, the last stronghold of Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen. The advances have raised concerns in the Saudi-led coalition and their allies, including the U.S. The U.S. called on Ansarullah to hold its offensive on the city of Ma'arib and end the strikes on Saudi Arabia. The movement, however, says the call proves U.S. support for the terrorist elements in the city.
The Battle of Ma'arib has been ongoing for more than 5 years. The U.S. calls to stop military operations have no meaning except confirming that America supports Daesh and al-Qaeda elements in Ma'arib, which the Yemeni army seeks to clean the city from.
The political leadership in Sana'a says the movement wants a political solution to the long-running crisis in Yemen. However, it requires the Saudi Arabia stop the aggression and the siege. The movement says the U.S. is also an aggressor and has no right to call for a halt to military operations.
Certainly, the Yemeni army will never stop its military operations unless under a decision by the Yemeni leadership. We are committed to liberating all Yemeni lands from the invaders when the time comes. The U.S. is itself an aggressor in Yemen war and is not in a position to call for a halt to military operations.
The Yemeni army has also intensified its strikes against Saudi Arabia, targeting facilities as Abha and Jeddah Airport several times recently.
Yemenis say it is only a matter of time until the Yemeni army liberates Marib City. They say this will force Saudi Arabia to stop the war and the blockade and move toward a political solution. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Antigua protesters have held new rallies in Myanmar despite a buildup of troops and fears of violence. People hit the streets in the largest city, Yangon, demanding their civilian leaders to be reinstated. They also want the release of the de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other officials from detention. The military has increased security in the past few days as anti-coup protests have continued. The UN Rapporteur for Myanmar has said that he fears the situation could spiral out of control. The military seized power on February the 1st over voter fraud in November's elections, but it denies that was a coup and says is ready to hand over power to whoever wins new elections. Nigerian officials say gunmen have abducted dozens of schoolboys in the central state of Niger. Officials say one student was fatally shot after the gunmen stormed a secondary school. The officials say that 42 people, including 27 students, have been kidnapped. They say that some, along with staff members, have managed to escape. The Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has condemned the abduction and ordered an operation to rescue all the captives. It's not clear yet who has taken them. Officials fear that the abductors have ties to the Boko Haram Takfiri terrorist group. Correspondent in Abuja, Danjuma Abdullahi, says there is no coordinated efforts at the federal level to tackle armed attacks and abductions.
There seems to be no coordinated effort at the federal level to tackle this. What seems to be happening is a reactive kind of approach to the issue. There is no proactive, coordinated effort that we can see as journalists and say that this is what is being done. The government usually condemns the attacks. Usually it sets up a team of operatives to rescue the abducted people, and then what we seem to do is wait for the next abduction. The governors of the Northwest Nigeria, where most of this is happening, even though it's happening all over the country, but it is more predominant in the northwest of Nigeria, there seems to be no agreement as to what kind of approach to take in handling this gunman.
Several European countries have reported more coronavirus deaths and infections as the continent is struggling with new variants of the disease. Russia registered 467 new deaths and nearly 13,000 more cases on Wednesday. More than 81,000 people have died in Russia, and over 4.1 million tested positive since the COVID outbreak. In Germany, authorities reported over 7,000 new cases, raising the country's total caseload to over 2.3 million. According to the Robert Koch Institute for Infectious Diseases, the death toll also rose by 560 to over 66,000. Meanwhile, the German health minister has warned that a UK variant is spreading rapidly in the country, saying that it now accounts for nearly 22% of the new cases.
The statistics show that the mutations are also spreading significantly in Germany, especially the variant of the virus that was first discovered in the UK. 2 weeks ago, this variant made up 6% of tested samples. In the meanwhile, the figure is over 20 to 22%. This means that, as has been seen in other countries, evidence of the mutation is doubling roughly every week. We must expect that this mutation could become the dominant virus in Germany.
Elsewhere in Europe, Polish health authorities have warned of a possible spike in cases in the coming weeks. They have estimated that in an optimistic scenario, daily infections could rise between 8 and 10,000. In Ukraine, the government has announced that it will prolong lockdown until the end of April in order to curb the spread of the virus. The country has so far recorded more than 1.3 million cases and nearly 26,000 deaths. The UN Human Rights Rapporteur has validated Venezuela's report about the economic damage caused by the U.S. and its allies through illegal seizure of Venezuelan cash and gold. Correspondent in Caracas, Jesus Silva, has more.
Following her visit to Venezuela, the UN Human Rights Envoy has certified the information given by Caracas regarding the devastating economic consequences of the confiscation of Venezuelan gold reserves that are worth 30 billion euros. The move by the United States and its allies, the UK and Portugal, is based on accusing the government of President Nicolas Maduro of not being legitimate. These foreign countries alleged that Venezuelan opposition figure Juan Guaido is the interim president of the South American nation, despite Venezuela's judiciary has ruled that he is not. While Maduro runs a legal battle trying to recuperate the gold, the dispute has worsened the country's economic crisis, as its oil companies abroad have also been illegally confiscated by the U.S. and its partner nations. Venezuelan authorities have denounced that the ongoing U.S. blockade has taken its toll on the Bolivarian Republic, pushing it on the verge of economic collapse, and this report was validated by the UN Human Rights Envoy, who visited Venezuela days ago. The UN diplomat has said Venezuela needs its gold to buy vaccines and save more lives from the COVID-19 outbreak. In this light, lawmakers stress they fully back Maduro's legal efforts to bring the gold back. Nonetheless, some opposition activists justify the U.S. measure against their homeland. However, experts consider that stripping Venezuela of its funds is unacceptable in legal terms. Venezuela faces the confiscation of its assets abroad, including gold reserves and oil industry branches. This move by the U.S. and its allies has harmed the country's economy, but President Maduro says he will not give up to the U.S. regime change policy. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new political spending analysis shows that former U.S. President Donald Trump's 2020 campaign and his joint fundraising committees paid more than $3.5 million to the individuals and firms involved in organizing the January 6th Stop the Steal rally that presaged the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kenny Stansil Ryder. This article is published under the heading Analysis Reveals Trump Operation Paid $3.5 Million to Organizers of Rally That Led to Deadly Capital Attack. Stay tuned, please. A new political spending analysis released recently shows that former President Donald Trump's 2020 campaign and his joint fundraising committees paid more than $3.5 million to the individuals and firms involved in organizing the January 6th Stop the Steal rally that presaged the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol. Investigators at Open Secrets, a project of the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics that examines how many influences U.S. elections and public policy, analyze recent Federal Election Commission FEC filings and found newly identified payments that show people involved in organizing the protest on January 6th received even larger sums from Trump's 2020 campaign than previously known. The findings come in the midst of the Senate impeachment trial that will determine whether or not Trump will be convicted for inciting the violent insurrection carried out by a mob of his supporters. Anna Masoglia, one of the campaign finance researchers who unearthed more than $3.5 million in direct payments from the then president's political operation to the January 6 organizers, wrote that there are unanswered questions about the full extent of Trump's ties to the incendiary demonstration that preceded the pro-Trump mob's invasion of the halls of Congress. Recent FEC filings show at least three individuals listed on permit records for the Washington, D.C. demonstration were on the Trump campaign's payroll through November 30, 2020. Masoglia noted, the Trump campaign paid Event Strategies Incorporation, a firm named in a permit for the rally that also employed two individuals involved in the demonstration, as recently as December 15th, just 3 weeks before the attacks on the U.S. Capitol. And yet, because the campaign used an opaque payment scheme that concealed details of hundreds of millions of dollars in spending by routing payments through shell companies where the ultimate payee is hidden, Masoglia wrote. The American public may never know the full extent of the Trump's campaign payments to organizers involved in the protest. The permit for the so-called Save America rally hosted by a pro-Trump nonprofit group called Women for America First did not explicitly allow for a march from the rally location, which was near the White House to the Capitol. Truthout reported recently, but it does say that some participants may leave to attend rallies at the United States Capitol. Despite their attempts to distance themselves from the rally, the Associated Press reported last month that members of the Trump campaign played key roles in orchestrating the Washington rally that spawned a deadly assault on the U.S. Capitol, undercutting claims the event was brainchild of President's grassroots supporters. In a statement shared with AP, Trump's failed re-election campaign claimed that it did not organize, operate, or finance the event, and that if any former employees or independent contractors participated, they did not do so at the direction of Trump campaign. The AP's review of records, however, found evidence to the contrary. Megan Powers, whose LinkedIn profile said she was still the Trump campaign's director of operations into January 2021, was listed as one of the two operations managers for the January 6th event. And at least three of the Trump campaign aides named on the permit rushed to obscure their connections to the demonstration. According to Masoglia, demonstrating the full extent of Trump campaign's involvement in the conspiratorial demonstration that preceded the deadly attack on the Capitol is made more difficult by the rise of shell companies and politically active nonprofit channeling money from untraceable sources. She continued, Trump's 2020 campaign and joint fundraising committee, the Trump Make America Great Again Committee, spent more than $771 million through American-made media consultants, LLC, according to new data analyzed by Open Secrets. The secretive limited liability company was created by campaign aides and members of Trump's inner circle to act as a clearinghouse to pay vendors, concealing the campaign's transactions with those vendors. The FEC generally does not require campaigns to detail payments vendors make to subcontractors so long as the campaign does not have undue influence over the vendor and the subcontractor does not work under the direction or control of the campaign. But the role individuals in Trump's inner circle played in creating the limited liability company through which the campaign routed millions of dollars raises the question of whether the company is truly separate from the campaign. The former president's son-in-law and White House advisor, Jared Kushner, reportedly helped create the limited liability company, and his daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, reportedly sat on its board. The nonpartisan Campaign Legal Center filed an FEC complaint alleging that the Trump campaign and its joint fundraising committee may have violated federal election reporting rules by laundering those funds and concealing details of the campaign's financial dealings. The role of non-profit dark money groups that do not disclose their donors in organizing the demonstrations on January 6 only adds to the opacity. Politically active non-profits are only required to report limited information about their financial dealings in tax filings more than a year after activities take place and may be able to keep their funders secret forever, Massaglia added. The lack of transparency required of such groups means many details of who they pay and who bankrolls their activities can remain hidden. Despite those limitations, the recent findings by Open Secrets of explicit financial connections between the Trump campaign and the organizers of the January 6 rally that culminated in a coup attempt corroborate the case for Trump's conviction being made by the House impeachment managers. As the House Democrats have shown, Trump told his followers for months that their victory was stolen, the election was rigged, and then a Congress prepared to testify President Joe Biden's victory on January 6. Trump told a well-armed crowd their patriotic duty was to fight to stop the steal, as Representative Eric Swalwell said. The political spending data unearthed by Open Secrets further substantiates, as Truthout noted, the arguments of Representative Jamie Raskin, Representative Joe Negus, Dell, Stacey Plaskett, and others, that many of the events surrounding the attack on the Capitol were premeditated, and that Trump and his team knew this and egged it on. Regarding the FEC, the sole federal agency tasked with enforcing campaign finance law, Massaglia pointed out that it was largely powerless throughout the 2020 election cycle due to a lack of commissioners. With its quorum restored, the FEC can again vote on enforcement matters addressing a backlog of complaints alleging campaign finance violations. The possibility that a failed presidential candidate's campaign may have continued bankrolling operatives behind a rally that escalated to violent insurrection raises a question of how this could have been hidden from the American public, she wrote, and raises the stakes for campaign finance transparency to a new level.
The first methodology that the Quran uses
is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, or you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
Sadir al-Sayrafi, a companion of Imam al-Sadiq, not a very high-level companion. He's not even similar to Zurara. Zurara, we have a lot of hadith from him, but in terms of his devotion to the Imam, his understanding of the status of the Imam, I wouldn't, based on my knowledge, my understanding, his ahadith, his conversations, we have certain conversations in Al-Kafi and in Rijal al-Kashi that he has with Imam al-Baqir and Imam al-Sadiq, it seems. It doesn't tell us that his level of understanding of the status of the Imams is way up there. But Sadir is not even comparable to Zurara. Sadir tells us, since we were sitting in a public gathering, there are different people sitting there, there are non-Shias there, and we are there as well. He names a few of the companions of the Imam, and probably there are others there. So it's a gathering that Shia and non-Shia are sitting there, the Imam is speaking, he comes in, the Imam walks into the room, and he says the following. He says, they say we have ilmul ghaib. They say we have ilmul ghaib. Then he continues, he says, if I had ilmul ghaib, I would know where my slave is. They've done something, they needed a spanking, the Imam said, I wish, or if I had ilmul ghaib, I would know where they are. Sadia said the session was over, the Imam walked out, we followed him, I went to the Imam and I told him, Ya Abu Abdullah, we believe in you, we believe that we need to obey your command, but we don't believe that you have ilmul ghaib. The Imam tells him, have you read the Quran? He says, yes. Have you read the verse that talks about the companion of Sulaiman, the one who brought the throne of Bilqis in a blink of an eye? He says, yes. It says, من كان عنده علم من الكتاب, the one that has a knowledge of the book. Partial, the min there means a knowledge from the book. It's a partial knowledge. This individual who is able not to simply know where the throne of Bilqis is without traveling there, without being there, he was able to bring the throne of the queen of Saba from Yemen to the Holy Lands in a blink of an eye. This is the Quran. This is not some hadith that Imam says to him, have you read that verse? He says, yes. He says, does he have more knowledge or what the other verse says? Man kana indahu ilmul kitab. The one that has, there's another verse, I don't remember the full verse. If I remember correctly, there's a couple of verses with that reference. The one who has knowledge of the book, it's not partial. Ilmul kitab, the knowledge of the book, the whole thing. He says, which one has got more knowledge? This is obviously the second. He said, we are man indahu ilmul kitab. Imam al-Sadiq's time, Sadir, a companion of the Imam, he comes around, spends time with the Imam, tells him, we don't believe that you have knowledge of the unseen. And the enemies of Islam used that piece of information and started spreading it to those who can't digest this in order to make them stay away from, well, these guys are deviant. They believe that a man has knowledge of the unseen. One of the reasons why this is so important is that in terms of spiritual development, getting close to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is the goal of our creation, there is no path but the path of the Ahlul Bayt. By that, I don't mean the words of the Ahlul Bayt. By that, I don't mean even this ziyarah of the Ahlul Bayt. By that, I mean the Ahlul Bayt themselves.
The Ahlul Bayt have got to take your hand and take you up there. There is just no other way. I was watching a few interviews regarding one of the great urafa that we have had. Ayatullah Khushfakhmi, Allah bless his soul, this great man, a student of Allama Tabatabai. If you saw him, you wouldn't have ever thought this guy is anything special. You would probably think that any other Maulana that you have seen has got more abilities than this guy. He would hide. He would not show. He wouldn't. He would only say, oh, taqwa, taqwa, taqwa. The only thing he repeated, and that you'll find it in the, if you ever get to watch this program that was made on Iranian television for him, interviews, that's the only thing that he repeated is taqwa. Taqwa. Oh, taqwa is very simple. Everybody knows that. Every Friday, every speaker mentions that taqwa. Be careful of what you do. Do your wajibat, stay away from haram. Very simple. There were some that spent a lot of time with him and tried to get him to open up and say some things. One of them is one of those interviewed in this program. It was a friend of mine, actually. We were in the same class in Qom. He said one day I went to him, he was sitting in the mihrab, alone, nobody's around him. I came close to him. He said, I used to ask him questions when you were young. What about this? When you were young, what happened here? When you were younger, trying to get him to say, how did he reach the level he did? And by the way, I'll tell you, I mean, again, I can't really put it in words. One of the others who was interviewed said that everything he did or said was with wisdom. I firmly believe that because I've seen that. Okay. And he's not even a ma'soom. He's not even a ma'soom. You can get there without... Just imagine what the ma'soomeen mean. That's why you need to read these ziyarat to realize that these things are nothing to where the Ahlul Bayt are. If you see someone who's got wisdom in every word they say, the tone of their voice, every time they're silent, if there's wisdom in it, don't think that's how far up the Ahlul Bayt are. That's nothing compared to the Ahlul Bayt. And I seriously mean that. Anyhow, back to this. We're trying to get the spiritual path, the Ahlul Bayt. He said, I kept going to this, to Adla Khushbaq, and asked him, when you were young, you know, what about this? What about that? What did you do? So this time I went to the Mihram. As soon as I said, when you were young, he said, look, I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened. I just know they took me and put me here. That's it. That is it. That's it. And it started with the wilayah of the Ahlul Bayt. Wilayah. He said, what do you mean by the wilayah of the Ahlul Bayt? He said, the matam, the recitations, the get-togethers, the mentioning of the Ahlul Bayt. This is where it starts with this. It started with this. They took the Ahlul Bayt have got to take your hand and put you there. There is no other way. There's no other way. The way this is going to happen, the way we can, the Ahlul Bayt can put us, their rahmah, if they are manifestations of divine mercy, the manifestation of divine mercy does not limit His mercy. Allah's mercy is not limited. The problem is this type of rahmah, that status is something that cannot be given without the person coming. They put out seeds for people to come. Not everybody takes the bait. You got to take that bait and get close to them. Get close to the Ahlul Bayt. The Ahlul Bayt need to take you there. You got to go to them. How can I go to them begging them for this? By reading the ziyarat. By knowing their status. By realizing where they are. I don't know. I don't know of any better way of explaining this. This is very deficient, but it's best I can do. If we want to, and we should want to, that's what the Ahlul Bayt spent their lives. What they wanted was students to come, people to come, individuals to come, get this great blessing, not ask for physical health or material blessings or a better car or a better life or any of that, although they gave all of that too for people to realize they are able to give from Allah as God's agents. They wanted was this, that's what they spent. If we want to get there, the only way is that connection with the Ahlul Bayt. A connection with the Ahlul Bayt. A deep connection with the Ahlul Bayt. A connection that sees the Ahlul Bayt, or tries to, I rather should say, tries to see more and more who the Ahlul Bayt really are, and gets to process that slowly, slowly, gradually.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. American legal experts, political observers, and government watchdogs are calling for criminal prosecution as the only remaining path for accountability and to prevent the disgraced former U.S. President Donald Trump from ever seeking elected office again. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by John Quayle, editor, which is published under the heading, It Does Not End Here, Calls Mount for Trump to be Tried in Criminal Court. Stay tuned for details, please. In the wake of the failure of the U.S. Senate to convict Donald Trump for his alleged incitement of the violent insurrectionist attack at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, legal experts, political observers, and government watchdogs are calling for criminal prosecution as the only remaining path for accountability and to prevent the disgraced former president from ever seeking elected office again. Writing for the Arizona Republic, columnist E.J. Montini argues that the Senate's refusal to convict has nothing to do with holding Trump to account in the nation's civilian justice system. The op-ed argues that if the adage, nobody is above the law, is true, then Trump should be charged with the exact same crime covered in the impeachment, only in criminal court. According to Montini, it's there under the U.S. Criminal Code, Title 18, Section 2383. The law is simple and straightforward. It reads, whoever incites, sets on foot, assists, or engages in any rebellion or insurrection against the authority of the United States, or the laws thereof, or gives aid or comfort thereto, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 10 years, or both, and shall be incapable of holding any office under the United States. Following the acquittal, Noah Buchbinder, president of the watchdog group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, CREW, called it a sad day for the U.S. democracy, but also suggested that Trump could still face prosecution in the courts. Trump incited an insurrection to overthrow the elected government of the United States. 43 senators stood with him. It does not end here, Buchbinder said in a statement. A partisan minority of senators may have been willing to place loyalty to Donald Trump over the loyalty to the United States of America, but that does not mean state and federal prosecutors will or that the American people will. Donald Trump's behavior was clearly criminal and was clearly abhorrent. He may have avoided one form of accountability, but he has not avoided all of them. According to the Associated Press, now a private citizen, Trump is stripped of his protection from legal liability that the presidency gave him. And separate reporting over the weekend cited people close to Trump who said he is concerned about the prospect of prosecution, both related to the events of January 6th and other political crimes. He's worried about it, one advisor close to Trump told CNN. As Lisa Gilbert, Executive Vice President of Public Citizen, put it, impeachment aside, Trump is unfit for future office and committed crimes against the American people. And whether through the courts, a commission, or other constitutional remedies, accountability will find him. In a CNN column recently, former attorney and radio host Dean Obidala urged President Joe Biden to call for a full criminal investigation into the role Trump played in the January 6th insurrection effort. At the outset, he wrote, let's be 100% clear that no criminal prosecution should ever be commenced for political reasons. That's illegal and truly un-American. Conversely, no prosecution should ever be rejected for political reasons either, such as hoping that by not prosecuting a political figure, it will foster more unity. That approach is just as wrong. He was hardly alone in making the argument that nothing in his Trump's Senate acquittal made only possible by the 43 Republican members in a minority who refused to convict. Prevents federal prosecutors from bringing a criminal case against the disgraced former president. Investigating and, if necessary, prosecuting Trump for the many crimes he is alleged to have committed over the years isn't political payback. It's simply the law doing its job against a potential felon, wrote Sasha Bromsky in The Nation recently. In fact, he argued, given the myriad and very specific allegations swirling around Trump, it would be an example of clear, illegitimate favoritism at this point to not investigate the ex-president, Abramsky continued. Bring on evidence, bring on the witnesses. If Trump is innocent, be it of inciting a mob, of avoiding taxes, or of threatening election officials, his top-flight lawyers will get every opportunity to prove their case, including by letting Trump himself take the stand to explain and justify his actions. But if the weight of evidence points to his malfeasance, and if juries find him to be guilty, surely even Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who so cynically voted to acquit Trump and then immediately announced that he held the man responsible for the lethal acts of January 6th, couldn't really object to the historical records being set just a little bit straight. In a 2019 HuffPost op-ed calling for Trump to be prosecuted in court for his many alleged crimes to the fullest extent of the law, Jeff Hauser, co-director of the Revolving Door Project, wrote, "The end of Trumpism will not be when Trump is defeated at the polls or even when he is impeached. It will be when America comes together as a nation and acts to ensure that elites like Trump, who transgress against shared laws, suffer consequences proportionate to their actions." On Sunday morning, following the former president's acquittal by the Senate, Hauser linked to his op-ed and tweeted, "I wrote this piece 25 months ago and I stand by it."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kHz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
All praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household, especially the one remaining with Allah on earth. I greet the dear people of Qom and the Honorable Islamic Seminary of that city. Unfortunately, the circumstances for this year's annual meeting are like this, and I am deprived of seeing the enlightened faces of dear brothers from Qom. But this is life. It is one of the ups and downs. Life is full of such highs and lows, and we should tread the path of life. This will pass by Allah's favor. This incident too is a transient one, like all other bitter and sweet incidents in life. By Allah's favor and grace, we will be upon the paved road once again.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Today, I will discuss a few points about the important event and epic of 19th of Dhi. Also, I will raise a few points about some of the current issues that have occupied the attention of public opinion in the country. But before I enter into the main discussion, I wish to thank God and to thank the dear people of our country for their great and glorious movement on the day of martyrdom anniversary of our dear martyr, Shahid Soleimani. Shahid Soleimani and Shahid Abu Mahdi were revived in the voluntary movement of people from throughout the country. With that great popular movement, a fresh impetus was given to the country, one that could not be created with any directive and any edict. The movement originated from the people's emotions, hearts, insights, and motives. The same is true of the great and astonishing gathering organized in Baghdad and other cities of Iraq with the purpose of commemorating Shahid Abu Mahdi, the outstanding Iraqi commander, and Shahid Soleimani, the dear guest of the Iraqi people. I sincerely thank all the brothers and sisters who participated in that ceremony in our country and in Iraq.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.